Hello, I'm Jonathan Birchall and I'm the host of Law Talks. Law Talks is the podcast about human rights law. It's produced by the Open Society Justice Initiative of the Open Society Foundations. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees believes that at least 12.5 million people around the world are stateless. The figure may be as high as 15 million stateless people. An individual is stateless when they're not recognized by any country as a citizen. They have no national ID card, no passport. They live in a legal limbo, often missing out as a result on basic services such as education or proper healthcare. Our guest in this edition is Laura Bingham, who works at the Open Society Justice Initiative on efforts to combat statelessness around the world using tools that include international litigation. So Laura, to start off with, could you just give me a broad explanation of what is statelessness? I mean, legally, what are we talking about?
The legal definition of statelessness is essentially the lack of nationality under the operation of the laws of any state. But conceptually, statelessness means that you don't really have access to rights or protection of any state.
What does that mean for the average person?
We say that statelessness means you don't have access to education, you don't have access to healthcare, you don't have access to employment. It means that children can't go to school if their parents don't have ID cards. So children don't receive an education. When I think about my childhood, I went to school every day. That's an impossibility for a stateless person or a person whose parents are stateless and who's inherited statelessness.
What about travel?
Travel without a passport, without access to any kind of formalized proof of identity, travel is virtually impossible. Even travel within a state is difficult. Working is often impossible or has to be under the table so that the worker has no rights and is vulnerable to any number of abuses.
When we talk about stateless populations, who are we talking about?
Some examples of entire populations of stateless persons. One example occurs in Kenya. We've worked with a group for many years, the Kenyan Nubians, who mainly about 50% of them live in the Kibera slum, which is in Nairobi, the capital. This is a group that's lived in Kenya for over a century, but they've never actually been recognized by the state as Kenyans. The reason that many Nubians are what we would call stateless is because some low-level actors and some higher-level regional actors won't issue them identity documents. So as you said, oftentimes statelessness occurs because of lack of documentation. Nationality is expressed legally in a variety of different ways depending on the laws that exist in a given state. In Kenya, you can't really access any of the services that we just talked about without having an identity card, which is something that all Kenyans are issued at the age of 18. So Kenyan Nubians, just simply by dint of their name sounding, quote, not Kenyan or sounding Nubian, or their religious affiliation, or just the knowledge of local officials about their family background, are not issued identity documents. And so they do not have access to all of the basic services that Kenyan state provides.
So there are examples of states essentially deciding that one group of people, even if they've been there for hundreds of decades, don't qualify as being nationals.
That's right.
And so maybe I was thinking of Burma. You have the Rohingya who the Burmese say come from Bangladesh and the Bangladesh say they come from Burma and they end up stateless.
That's right. That's right. This happens frequently. Two states essentially disowning entire groups based on their background.
And that is often related to the issue of state secession when two states break up?
The issue of state secession is a little bit different. And obviously it varies depending on the circumstances. In the former Yugoslavia and after the breakup of the Soviet Union, so within the larger European context, state secession actually, it wasn't necessarily states disowning. I would say a lot of the problems were on that more technical level, where new nationality laws of the nascent states simply conflicted, or there were residency requirements. And this happened. This is a case that was before the European Court of Human Rights just this past summer, before the Grand Chamber, in Kuric versus Slovenia. Before the breakup, citizens would be would have both federal citizenship and citizenship of a republic. So after the breakup, they lost their federal citizenship, obviously, and each republic redrafted its own nationality laws. So citizens of, say, Croatia who were living in Slovenia wouldn't necessarily have a residency status in Slovenia because they could freely move within the republic. After the breakup, Slovenia instituted a requirement to register as a resident, and many people missed that. After missing the deadline, they weren't able to put themselves on a path to citizenship. And after a certain number of years, a very short timeline, Slovenia simply erased these people. Even though they had made their lives there, they may have lived there for generations. So their names were erased from the registry of permanent residents as if they had never lived there.
So you have people who are stateless because the government's decided it doesn't want them to be nationals. Then you have people who are stateless kind of in a bureaucratic limbo, a sort of bureaucratic mistake.
That's right. Although, just one more point, in that situation, many of the people who did not register came from a Roma background. So in a sense, these maneuvers by the state, while you could look at them as simply technical problems, technical issues, there was an element of discrimination.
So it's an element of indirect discrimination, which we talk about in one of our other podcasts with Julia Harrington Reddy. So that's the problem. What's the position of international law on this?
The position of international law is, I would say, compared to some of the other areas where the Justice Initiative works, relatively weak. There are two United Nations conventions that address statelessness. They're not very well ratified. The 1954 Convention on the Status of Stateless Persons actually has that legal definition of statelessness in Article 1.1, but it's only been ratified by about 70 states.
And that's saying that a stateless person is an individual not considered as a national by any state under the operation of its law.
That's right.
Right.
And the remainder of the convention addresses both mechanisms for granting stateless status, because it is a status under international law under this convention, in accordance with the mandate of the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. The convention also talks about treatment that should be accorded to stateless persons once they have this status under international law. I should also mention that the definition itself that you just read is also widely recognized as customary international law. So it is binding on states beyond those that have ratified the convention. There's also a sister convention, the 1961 Convention on the Reduction of Statelessness, which does address some of the problems raised in the cases of state succession. There are several different ways that statelessness arises in the world, and this convention is meant to address them. The chief reason is that statelessness is inherited from one generation to the next, because in most states, citizenship is inherited by bloodline. It's passed on from generation to generation. And the 1961 convention contains an important provision that permits a child born on a state party, on the territory of a state party, to inherit the nationality of that state.
And that's our overall view, is that we'd like to see that principle accepted by countries around the world.
For children born on a territory who would otherwise be stateless.
Right. But how then, as a lawyer who wants to bring litigation on behalf of a stateless group, how do you go about doing that? You have these international principles, but what if the country hasn't ratified that convention? Is there anything you can do?
Well, as we've been discussing, many of the problems around the treatment of stateless persons, around the creation of statelessness, aren't actually even addressed in those treaties. We talked about discrimination. That's a huge factor in the creation of statelessness. We talked about the lack of protection under international human rights treaties in general for stateless persons. So the tools that we use are outside of that. We rely heavily on non-discrimination norms, This is not just the UN CERD, but non-discrimination.
Sorry, what's the CERD?
That's the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. So we do
and
rely.
And that's been more broadly signed, more broadly.
Yes, far more broadly signed, as is the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. As I mentioned, statelessness can be inherited. This is one of the chief causes of statelessness, is that it's inherited from one generation to the next. So we do focus a lot of our work on children, stateless children. And the CRC, this Convention on the Rights of the Child, contains some provisions that we can work with in Articles 7 and 8 that address the right to nationality for children.
So you, rather than using this statelessness convention, which isn't very well accepted, you use the Rights of the Child Convention and anti-discrimination conventions as a basis for bringing actions at regional and international courts.
Right. In addition to non-discrimination norms, as I've mentioned, the provision in the CRC that we focus on is the provision that elaborates the right to nationality, which is also an area of law that we use as a tool. The right to nationality is recognized in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 15. The UDHR is not a binding instrument, it's a declaration. It's a progressive document. So that Article 15 right to nationality and its twin right against arbitrary deprivation of nationality, we rely on them, but we also have to construct arguments that contain additional either soft law or hard law obligations, because we can't simply rely on Article 15, as we can't rely on the statelessness conventions.
So if we looked at the case of the Kenyan Nubians, could you talk us through the strategies that Justice Initiative has used so far in litigation?
I can talk about our great victory this year, which was actually under the African Convention on the Rights and Welfare of the Child, which is a regional instrument. We often rely on regional instruments because they contain more specific rights tailored to the kind of work that we do. And the African Children's Rights Convention actually does contain a fairly strong provision in Article 6 on the rights of the child to nationality, including the right to acquire the nationality of the state where one is born if one would otherwise be stateless. So in the Nubian case, for Nubian children, we essentially argued that from the time they're born, birth certificates in Kenya specifically state that they do not confer nationality and that they're not proof of nationality. So as we were discussing before, at the age of 18, all Kenyans apply for this ID card, which essentially is their ticket to access human rights in Kenya. For most Kenyans, that's a pro forma application. It doesn't present an issue. For Kenyan Nubians and certain other ethnic groups and people from certain religious backgrounds in Kenya, the process of applying for this ID card is extremely prolonged, and some of them never obtain an ID card. So for children, that period of limbo was what we really focused on. And at the same time, while they are growing up, they're deprived of access to health care because their parents are most often stateless. They're deprived of access to education. So we focused on the economic and social rights aspects of their plight as well. And we were successful. The committee that oversees the implementation of this Children's Rights Convention in Africa found in our favor. And specifically, the committee declared that Article 6 of the convention, of the charter, sorry, means that children should have a nationality at birth, not when they're 18. They shouldn't go through this period of limbo. That's not in the best interest of the child.
And that's an important ruling, not just for Kenya, right? could also be applied in other cases elsewhere in Africa?
It can be applied elsewhere in Africa. It applies to all states party. Also, for us, it's an important tool because that's the first time that anybody before which we work has really clarified that point, that the right to nationality or the right to acquire a nationality means that you have to focus on the moment of birth. And that's the key moment. So you can't leave people in limbo.
And how can we then use that in Kenya itself to try and change the situation?
I just focus on the fact that it's not necessarily the law. The nationality law and implementing regulations in Kenya are they do allow for too much discretion at the local level. But it's really the practices and the attitudes in Kenya that we have to combat. So in terms of implementation of the decision, it's actually a good moment for us because Kenya is currently in the process of redrafting much of its legislation in the wake of the constitutional reforms after the post-election violence in 2008. So one mechanism that we've used is this process of legal reform, because that's one of the key things that we ask for in any complaint to anybody is that the laws should be reformed.
So we and our allies and other partners would participate in those debates and have that ruling from the Committee on Children to back it up, to back up the argument.
That's right. We incorporate it into our suggested reforms, essentially, into our recommendations. We've also gone back to the Nubian community and explained the decision to them, explained what it means, and assisted them in publicizing it and celebrating it in their within their community and sharing it with other communities that are impacted by the same policies and practices in Kenya.
To build the case which you took to the African Union Committee, what kind of work did you have to do? What kind of evidence did you bring?
We collected affidavits. I think that in any of our human rights cases, that's a key component because this is how we tell the story of the applicants. We also obviously analyzed the laws. It's interesting. So part of, I didn't really talk about the process of obtaining an ID card for Nubians. The reason why it takes so much longer is really twofold. Oftentimes, they're asked to produce additional documentation, additional proof that they are Kenyan. This can include even producing grandparents' birth certificates, the kinds of records that are rarely kept anywhere, and certainly not when groups are living in the kinds of conditions where most Nubians live and where they're uneducated, and often their grandparents weren't issued identity documentation. And the second factor that really retards this process is the Nubians have to present themselves before what's called vetting committees. So we spent a lot of time interviewing members of vetting committees and tried to get a sense of how their decision making took place and why the process took so long and why it was only happening to Nubians.
And then you used that evidence as to build the case which we took to the complaint to the African Committee.
That's right. And right. We also had a sister case before the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. So we were gathering evidence for both cases, and the evidence for the committee focused on children. So I think we focused more on the deprivation of access to education and deprivation of access to healthcare, some of the economic and social and cultural rights.
Now you've got this ruling, can you take it into other legal fora outside Africa?
Certainly. We plan to use it as support for our legal arguments across the board, just as I said, because it's so strong on certain points that we're trying to develop. It's also a strong advocacy tool for us. So we wouldn't just be using it in court cases. We would also be broadcasting it in all of our advocacy materials.
Are there other cases we're working on beyond Kenya that you could summarize?
Certainly. We're working on a case, just in the context of Africa, we're developing a case in Burundi, which is in the early stages, but essentially a group of Swahili speakers in Burundi has been consistently denied access to citizenship. We've met with them a couple of times, this community, and they find themselves in the awkward position of not really being able to even litigate or advocate for themselves because the state hasn't granted them registration as a group because the government said that it doesn't recognize the minority that they claim to represent. So essentially, even though they claim to be a minority of Swahili speakers that's being discriminated against within Burundi, the Burundian government says that there is no such minority at all. So not only are they having trouble obtaining documentation of citizenship, they're also having trouble even establishing their existence. So one case in the early stages that we're considering taking to either the East African Court of Justice or the African Commission. We have an ongoing case in Côte d'Ivoire, which is a complicated situation because the discrimination against Northerners, and which has created statelessness within Côte d'Ivoire, has also fueled the conflict that raged there for years.
And Côte d'Ivoire is a good demonstration, isn't it, of the how statelessness becomes more than just a personal inconvenience, that it can become a factor in regional conflict.
That's right. It can be a seriously destabilizing factor. And this, I think, worldwide, but especially in the context, in the African context, where, as in Kenya, statelessness coincides with ethnic discrimination on a group level, a tribal level, and this is how it's you know, in general, this is how it's occurred in Côte d'Ivoire. It's south against north. Northerners are perceived as foreigners because they come from different tribes or different groups, as opposed to the southerners who were controlling the state mechanism. And gradually, the Northerners saw their rights being stripped away. There's a great quote in one of the OSI publications on struggles for citizenship in Africa that essentially the Northerners had to go to war because they had to get their identity documents.
Right. And also in Mauritania, I think as well, there's been recent trouble over a census because people have been concerned that they were going to lose citizenship.
Well, in Mauritania, the story goes back much further, obviously. The group that's concerned about having their rights taken away or being classified as non-citizens is actually a group that was expelled and had their identity documents ripped apart. Essentially, they were denationalized in the tens of thousands and expelled into Senegal and Mali. These are the black Mauritanians that primarily lived in the south of the country. They've been gradually repatriated over the ensuing decades. And now that Mauritania is commencing a census, there are fears that accurate records weren't kept when this group was repatriated and that in the process of the census, yes, they would once again find themselves without protection.
And if we look globally, say over the last 10 years since Open Society Justice Initiative started its work, hasn't one of the big problems been that nobody cares about stateless people because they are stateless? They don't have a political lobby. Is that one of the challenges in advancing this issue?
It certainly is. I think one thing that we're frequently asked in a variety of contexts is how many people are stateless. In each, you know, how many Nubians are there? How many people what's the percentage of people in Côte d'Ivoire who are stateless? And it's very difficult to accurately identify stateless people. So I don't think it's so much that no one cares about statelessness as a phenomenon. I think it's that, as you alluded to, stateless people have no rights. They have no clout, and they are disenfranchised in every sense. But also, they're difficult to find. They're difficult to identify, and frequently, I'd say in most cases, they don't understand themselves that they are stateless or what that means.
You're listening to Law Talks, the podcast about international human rights law. Our guest has been Laura Bingham, a human rights lawyer working on equality and citizenship issues at the Open Society Justice Initiative of the Open Society Foundations. To find out more about our litigation work, please listen to other podcasts in this series or visit our website, justiceinitiative.org. That's justiceinitiative.org. I'm Jonathan Birchall. Thanks for listening.